This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, The Information Advantage. I'm Bill Hammack, substituting today for Celeste Quinn. Today, I take a deeper look at the relationship between technology and society. My guest today is the author of a book about mirrors called Mirror, Mirror. The book is more than merely a history of the looking glass. The author looks at mirrors with fresh wonder to help us understand their extraordinary place in human history. To him, the history of mirrors is the history of the humans who look into them. In fact, the book covers Aztec priests and Greek philosophers, Renaissance painters, Shakespearean heroes, vaudeville magicians, and especially modern astronomers. Let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine Mark Pendergrast.
Hello, Bill.
Mark, hi. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good. Mark, your book covers most everything. It has anthropology, it has myth, science, business, and espionage. And when did you first realize the scope of mirrors?
Well, when I was a kid, I liked looking in them. And I realized, like most human beings, probably around the age of two, that it was a me. The first time I remember anything about it was when I was about five, and I decided that I wanted to cut some of my hair off. And my mother got upset, and I explained that it wasn't really me. It was another little boy who had done it, and I think I had in mind the kid in the mirror. But mirrors, you know, they've always seemed magical to me. And it turns out when you look into other cultures and their histories, it's a common human reaction that your double in the mirror or the world you see in the mirror is a completely separate world. And, of course, this is a favorite theme of fantasy and science fiction writers, starting with Lewis Carroll and coming up to the present day to Harry Potter. But it also turns out that it tells us, you know, as you said, mirrors cover just about everything except the bathroom sink, and they're above that. So it turned out to be much more involved than I actually realized when I started the project. I had no idea I'd end up writing about X-ray astronomy, for instance, but I did.
Well, what are some of the things that you did in order then to learn about mirrors? What are some of the places you visited or the researches that you did?
Well, it was really interesting. I'm probably the only person in the world who's ever spent 2 months traveling through Europe specifically to look at bizarre mirrors. I went to a wonderful mirror maze in Lucerne that was built in the late 1800s. I went to one of the world's largest solar furnaces, a huge eight-story building built in the French Pyrenees where they get a lot of sun.
What is that furnace? Is that an ancient furnace? Is that something modern?
No, it's not ancient. It was built in the 1960s. It's in a place called Odeillo, O-D-E-I-L-L-O. And it's quite modern. It's the entire side of the building is shaped like a parabolic mirror, and they have heliostats, flat mirrors on a hillside facing it, that are controlled by computers so that they can direct the sun into this gigantic furnace. And so it then, at the focal point of that mirror, it gets incredibly hot. It gets to be about 3,000 degrees centigrade, and they specialize in you know, melting solid sheets of lead, you know, holes in them, things like that. But they primarily have used them for research on things like space reentry, the heat that you go through for that, or the effect of nuclear weapons and how to survive them.
So this is a scientific purpose, not an industrial purpose for this mirror.
It's primarily scientific. They do some industrial research applications for you know, how to work with very high heat. But, yeah, it's primarily scientific.
Now, in this book, you are roughly chronological as it goes through it, and you have kind of four themes in it. There's more than that, but about four main themes. One is about ancient mirrors and how they evolved to be ornamental, you know, essentially a part of 17th century decor. It's hard to imagine a mirror in an ancient time. What were the earliest mirrors, and what were they made out of?
Well, of course, the first human mirror probably was a still body of water, a natural mirror that we looked into. And in fact, I opened the book with this imagined scene of the first hominid looking and figuring out that they were seeing themselves. The first real mirror that's man-made that they found was from about 6200 BC, and it was found in what is now Turkey. And it was a piece of polished obsidian, which is a natural black glass made in a volcanic eruption. And then about 3,000 years after that, people during the Bronze Age and copper and iron and whatnot, they began to make mirrors out of copper and then bronze, the Sumerians and the Egyptians. And we have a lot of Egyptian mirrors because they buried them with people as part of their we believe it was part of their trying to capture the soul and help it go to the other world.
So these mirrors were then usually used for ritual or religious purposes?
Yes, most of them were, but they were also used from the very beginning for just vanity. I mean, if you look at some of the pictures that you see in some of the papyrus and things like that, the Greeks, I mean, the Egyptians certainly used makeup. Mm-hmm. A lot of makeup, and they applied it with the use of mirrors. But their priests also used it for mystification, to do optical illusions, and their scientists use it to direct light down into the pyramids that they were building. So all of the major themes of the book, including an amazing focus on sex, begins with the Egyptians.
Can you follow up with the amazing focus on sex? You mean for
ancient
times?
Well, it kept popping up throughout the history of mirrors. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought, well, you know, there would be a few kinky voyeurs who like to watch themselves in mirrors, but it turns out that this is pretty standard stuff for human beings right along. The Etruscans have very sexy drawings on the back of their mirrors, beautiful line drawings. They almost look like New Yorker cartoons. There was this Roman guy named Hostius Quadra that Seneca wrote about, who had a giant metal mirror, a concave mirror, which when you are inside the focal length of a concave mirror, it makes everything look larger, as anyone who's used a shaving mirror knows.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked to have, orgies in front of this mirror to make everything look bigger. He liked to watch himself. So, yes, I mean, and it keeps going. In the last chapter of the book, I think it's the most fascinating one of all, because I talked about the, what does it really mean to say that an animal recognizes itself in a mirror? What does it say about our essential nature? And the more I thought about this, the more I realized that it has a lot to do with the essential character of humans and what makes us able to write poetry and do science and think about our own deaths and a lot of things. And it turns out that chimpanzees and most other higher apes also can recognize themselves in mirrors. And now they are thinking that dolphins probably do, which is really fascinating because they have large brains, but they're not shaped. They don't have the same sort of brain that we do. And so if they evolved this ability, it's probably a kind of an independent evolution. At any rate, it turns out that one of the reasons they think dolphins recognize themselves in mirrors is that dolphins like to watch themselves have sex in mirrors.
Mm-hmm. So there's a folklore that other animals don't gaze at themselves, that that's something that makes us uniquely human. And your research showed that not to be true, right?
Well, it is true that most other animals do not recognize themselves in mirrors. Dogs don't. Monkeys don't. You can put a mirror in a cage with a monkey for years, and they have done this.
Mm-hmm.
And the monkey will never realize that it's him. There's a professor who's now at SUNY Albany named Gordon Gallup, who is the one who invented this mark test, which is quite clever, where they'll put a bright red mark above the eyebrow of a monkey, and then let it go in front of a mirror. And the monkey will never, ever touch its own head where the mark is, whereas a chimpanzee who's gotten used to mirrors will. They will know it's them.
So the chimpanzee notices that there is something not right in the reflection and wonders what is on the head of that other chimp. Is that what you're saying?
Well, and wonders what is on their head. They know it's them. Mm-hmm. They'll touch their own head where the mark is. They'll look in a mirror, identify, oh, my God, somebody's been messing with me, and touch themselves, whereas the monkey will never, ever do that. And you can't do the mark test with dolphins because they don't have any hands. So you have to sort of try to figure it out other ways, and I won't take the time to explain it, but I did write about it in the book, and it's quite interesting. So... Yeah, I it's not just folklore. They can do this mark test with human infants. And it turns out that between 1.5 and 2 years of age, human infants normally realize that they're looking at themselves. And they become quite self-conscious and sort of embarrassed almost and shy in front of the mirror at that point.
So you're looking here now at another theme of the book, which is a mirror really is a metaphor for our understanding of the world or even of ourselves. How did mirrors affect things like art and painting, particularly, I guess, in the Renaissance times?
Well, David Hockney has written a book called Secret Knowledge, in which he makes a very compelling case that the earliest artists from Jan van Eyck on, which is it was about 1425, were using mirrors and lenses of one sort or another. Now, David and I don't totally agree on what they were using. I think Jan van Eyck was using a convex mirror, which you can see in the very famous Arnold Fini portrait. There's a convex mirror right smack in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. But there's no question that the Italians were beginning to make very good flat mirrors. They had sort of a monopoly on the island of Murano, which I talked about. Mm-hmm. And they were making very good convex mirrors up north. And suddenly, you know, if you think about it, what does a mirror do? It represents three-dimensional reality absolutely perfectly on a flat surface. Mm-hmm. So all you've got to do is copy it. It puts a frame on it. And so you had people like Leonardo da Vinci writing about this. You had people like Albrecht Dürer doing many, many, many self-portraits. Well, how do you think people do self-portraits? They use mirrors. Mm-hmm. Rembrandt. And then the camera obscura, which doesn't necessarily use a mirror, but in order to make it really quite effective, you can. A camera obscura is just a dark room with a little pinhole, like a Brownie camera.
Mm-hmm.
And it projects the scene upside down. If you put a mirror there, it can flip it again to be right side up. And so people began to do that. Caravaggio probably used camera obscuras, and there's a lot of evidence for this sort of thing. Vermeer, Velasquez, a lot of artists were using it. And at the same time that they were becoming, mirrors were becoming more commonplace items. There was the same shift from the sacred to the secular in literature. So at first, like in the 1200s, 1300s, a lot of books were called mirrors of the world or mirrors of God, but they became more and more secular, and then by the time Shakespeare was writing, he used every conceivable kind of mirror metaphor, and a lot of the time he called them a glass, you know, like when Richard II is being defeated, he says, someone bring me a glass, and he means a looking glass.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at it and he says, well, this is lying. I look just the same as I always did. He's just been overthrown. And he dashes the mirror to the ground. It cracks into a million pieces. So it's this metaphor for his old self being destroyed. So it's fascinating stuff. It does sort of cover the gamut of human experience.
But you're really arguing here that mirrors helped bring in a more kind of humanist view in the Renaissance, and that's reflected directly in the art that we see, right?
Yes.
And in Shakespeare's plays, are there other ways that mirrors appear? Is there other scenes, or is that the only one?
There are innumerable scenes where they talk about mirrors. There are references to mirrors all over the place. I can't think, well, you know, and at the end of King Lear, when Cordelia has died, mm-hmm. and Lear's heart is breaking, and just before he dies, he asks someone to bring a mirror so that he can hold it up to her lips, so if she breathes on it, that you could see the steam on the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, look, you can see she's alive. She's not dead, but of course she is dead, and then he dies soon afterwards. So they were a part of daily life by then.
Mm-hmm.
Much more so than a century, even a century before that.
But in the case, for example, of Macbeth, the three weird sisters really have a mirror-like surface with a baboon blood at their bubbling cauldron.
Oh, yeah.
Did mirrors in Shakespeare often appear in these supernatural contexts? I mean, maybe you could describe that scene with the three weird sisters.
Well, we think of the cauldron bubbling and everything, but in fact, it was still while they were seeing their visions in it. That's called scrying. I have a whole chapter on this fine art of scrying.
Scrying. What exactly is scrying?
It's looking into a reflective surface and sort of going into a trance state. It's like a crystal ball gazing. Mm-hmm. Same is a form of scrying. Mm-hmm. And you think that you see visions of either the future or something happening a long way away, or that you're talking to angels or demons. And this is really, it's amazing how widespread this belief is. The Aztecs practiced this. My favorite character who practiced it was actually a contemporary of Shakespeare's named John Dee, who was an advisor to Queen Elizabeth I, and who became absolutely convinced that his scryer, whose name was Edward Kelly, was accurately talking to angels. And it basically took his life off the deep end. He ended up trading wives for the night with Edward Kelly because mm-hmm. the angels supposedly told him to, because Edward Kelly had the hots for Dee's wife. But John Dee was probably one of the role models for Prospero in The Tempest, mm-hmm. or for Dr. Faustus by Marlowe. He was quite famous.
So you mentioned kind of the cultural aspect of mirrors in Shakespeare's plays and in Renaissance arts and paintings, but also there are ways that they play into our a little more modern culture. You mentioned, for example, the famous Marx Brothers scene in Duck Soup,
mm-hmm.
and that's where Harpo acts as Groucho's reflection.
Right.
And one of the fascinating things is in this chapter, I think it was chapter 10, uh-huh. you pointed out the context of that scene, why what they were mocking.
Well, there were more and more really big mirrors in the 1920s and 1930s. There was a major transformation of U.S. culture during that same time period where people were really becoming what we are now, highly, highly self-conscious. Everything became image-oriented much more than it ever had been, and the sort of self-absorption of our culture, which I lament in many ways, really began then. Before the 1920s, there was not much of a cosmetics industry. Only actresses or women of the night wore lipstick or mascara or mm-hmm. whatever. By 1930, there were beauty shops all over the United States, and everybody was wearing makeup, and everybody was looking into the mirrors in the beauty shops, and they were also carrying around compact mirrors in their purse. It was perfectly okay to look at yourself like this. And so, you know, the Marx Brothers were just, they were just having a good time. But I think they were reflecting, in a way, some of the obsessions of their time. And then I also talked about this wonderful movie that should be rediscovered called The Lady from Shanghai that was made in 1948 with Orson Welles.
Mm-hmm.
And that movie ends in this wonderful, surreal scene that was shot in a mirror maze where people are shooting each other in the mirror maze, and they keep shooting the mirror, you know, so you see them crashing all around, and eventually mm-hmm. they shoot each other.
Did Welles actually direct Lady from Shanghai, or was he just an actor in that?
No, he directed it.
He directed it, okay.
And he was in it, yeah. Mm-hmm. I recommend it to anybody who likes good films. It's quite an amazing film.
So the penultimate scene involves all of these images and not knowing quite what to shoot at or quite what they're shooting at, is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. It was a matter of illusion and reality,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of, you know, a lot of good artists have played with that mm-hmm. aspect of mirrors.
This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with Mark Pendergrast, and we're talking about mirrors and their impact on human history from the Roman times to something we'll get to in a minute, which is telescopes. You can reach Mark via email at markp@nasw.org. That's markp@nasw.org. And you can also view his website at www.nasw.org/users/markp. And I'll give those addresses again in a little bit. I do invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL. If you're in the area or anywhere else, you can call us at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. So one of the big focuses of your book, in fact, I would say almost the bulk of it, is really about telescopes. You call the makers of telescopes as having sacred eyes and noting that they peer ever further into the mystery of God's universe. So how exactly are mirrors an important part of a telescope?
Well, what a mirror does is to collect light from a long way off and to concentrate it so that you can see further. Our eyes, you know, bare eyes can't see all that far. Galileo was the first one to really use telescopes in 1609 to look up in the sky, and he sort of revolutionized the way we thought about the universe. He only used a refracting telescope with lenses.
Well, what does refracting mean? It just...
Refracting is bending light.
Okay.
And the problem with just bending light is that, as Newton figured out, different colored light bends different amounts through the same medium.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get the refracting telescopes weren't very satisfactory. They had what's called chromatic aberration. They had little rainbows around them. And Newton was the first person to figure out that you could get around this by making a reflecting telescope using a mirror instead of lenses, because all of the light reflects together. You know, it just bounces according to the laws of reflection. The angle of incidence equals the angle of reflection.
So if we use lenses, the light gets kind of a, I guess it's called a chromic aberration, but the image decays after a while because of the separation of the light?
Well, it did in Newton's time, and he thought that there was no way to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that they did figure out pretty much how to fix it by using two different types of glass. If you put lead into the glass, then it changes the refractive index, the amount of bend that the light has. And so you can kind of correct for it. It still isn't ever perfect, but it's pretty good nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a limit to how big your lenses can get before they begin to sag and they begin to absorb too much light. And so the bigger they got, the more difficult they were to make. And a guy named William Herschel, who is sort of the hero of, I think, modern astronomy, he really pursued making bigger and bigger mirrors. Now, they were making them not out of glass, but out of metal. They hadn't figured out how to put silver efficiently onto glass.
So these were polished pieces of metal.
That's right, and they called them speculum. They called it speculum material.
When did William Herschel live? What period is that?
William Herschel lived in the late 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, contemporarily with the American Revolution, and he was his great champion was George III. In fact, I tried to resuscitate the reputation of poor old mad King George. He was really quite interested in science and very interested in astronomy, and he didn't go mad because he was crazy. He had a disease. So what happened was William Herschel was a German musician who ran away from the German army because he didn't like being shot at while he was playing music, and he went to England, learned English, and he was a very successful composer and choir director in Bath, England, which is was a very shishi resort where people would go to take the hot baths in the winter. And Herschel became obsessed with astronomy. And unlike most of the astronomers of his era, he wasn't satisfied with just positional astronomy. They just wanted to figure out where these pinpricks in the sky were so that they could win the longitude prize, you know, that Davis Sobel wrote about.
Sure, so they were interested in navigation mostly. And you're saying he went beyond that?
Yeah, he went way beyond that. He was interested in looking in depth and penetrating back into space and time. And he's the first person who realized that you could use mirrors as time machines. The bigger you could make the mirror and the more accurate you could make it, you had to make it in a parabolic shape so that it will focus light rays coming at a distance in parallel to one point. And he got to be extremely good at this in a sort of obsessive way. He almost killed himself doing it various times.
What do you mean, just by overwork or by actually the physical dangers of making these
mirrors? By the physical dangers of making the glass. He was trying to make, for instance, a glass down in the basement in Bath, and it was a flagstone basement. and the mold he was making out of, he had a huge mold made out of dried horse manure, and it leaked. Mm-hmm. And when the hot metal hit the cold flagstones, they exploded up to the ceiling, and everybody had to run out or they would have been killed, so that sort of thing. Or another time, he had built a huge telescope, a 40-foot-long telescope with a 4-foot-wide solid metal mirror, and he was taking it out of the telescope to try to, you know, to repolish it, and the winch broke, and it fell, and he almost was under it, in which case he would have been crushed.
So how big were these mirrors that he was making in the 1700s?
Well, the biggest one he made was 4 feet wide,
okay,
which is huge. I mean, and weighed an unbelievable amount. It was never a successful telescope. The one that he made that was much more successful was about a couple of feet wide.
Mm-hmm.
But what he did with that was, number one, he discovered the planet Uranus.
Mm-hmm.
Or Uranus, as we prefer to pronounce it, so as not to confuse it with a bodily part.
Sure.
He didn't call it that at all. He called it Georgium Sidious. In other words, he named it after George III, hoping that George III would give him enough money so he could stop being a musician, quit his day job,
mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. George III gave him enough money so that he could quit his job and devote himself entirely to astronomy. In his 40s, and he did in a major way. And what he revealed and what he found out, you know, he's the first person to really realize that probably that we were in the middle of the Milky Way, that the Milky Way was probably a galaxy, that there were probably all these other galaxies outside of us. He called them island universes.
Mm-hmm.
And no one really knew for sure that was correct. In fact, most people thought it was incorrect until the 1920s. This is incredible to me. Until the 1920s, most reputable scientists thought that the entire universe was inside the Milky Way. That was all there was to it. And so it's only been really in the last 80 years that we've done all of modern astronomy. And we've done that by making bigger and bigger mirrors. And so I told a lot of the story of the obsessive, quirky, fascinating individuals who've done that.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up to the modern era, you ask where I'd traveled. One of the places I went was to Tucson, to underneath the football stadium of the University of Arizona, where Roger Angel makes some of the world's largest telescope mirrors. And he does it because that's the only place on campus big enough.
big enough to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And he spins them. If you spin a liquid, it forms a parabolic shape.
Mm-hmm.
And so he spins them at a particular speed and figures this all out mathematically. These guys are very smart.
Mm-hmm.
And makes glass mirrors just the right shape and then polishes them. Right today, mostly, they don't put silver on mirrors. They put aluminum on astronomical mirrors.
Why is that?
It doesn't tarnish as much.
Mm-hmm.
And it has pretty good reflective qualities.
Mm-hmm.
Different metals will reflect different wavelengths, one way or the other. But I also sort of, I don't know how much time we've got left. I wanted to talk a little bit about, I did not intend to write about radio astronomy or
mm-hmm.
X-ray astronomy, but I ended up doing that because I realized that light, what we call light, is really what scientists call electromagnetic radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mystery. They don't even understand it.
What do you mean by it's a mystery?
Light.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
You mean a particle, a wave, this kind of mystery?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a particle? Is it a wave?
Mm-hmm.
Does it have any mass? No.
Mm-hmm.
Does it have the power to affect our lives? Yes. Does it?
Mm-hmm.
Does it? The best definition I got of light, because I kept asking these physicists, what is light? What is it? Because you can't see it until it hits something. It's invisible. And it goes at a particular speed, a very, very fast speed, but nonetheless a speed. And it seems to be a photon, a particle, and yet when you look at it, it acts like a wave. And finally, one of these astrophysicists I interviewed said, well, I regard light as the energy delivery system of the universe. Because of E equals MC squared. Mm-hmm. When it hits your eye, it's turning into an electrical impulse, electrons, or chemical, or if you will. Anyway, I became really fascinated with the characteristics of light, so there's a lot about that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I also realized that what we see is a very narrow range of electromagnetic radiation, because we evolved in order to take advantage of this little chink that the Earth's atmosphere lets through.
Mm-hmm.
We can see that, but the ultraviolet and the infrared on either side are primarily blocked by the Earth's atmosphere, and thank God X-rays are blocked, or we would all be fried.
Mm-hmm.
But on the longer end of things, radio waves, most of them come through, but they're quite long. And if we had evolved eyes in order to take advantage of that fact, then we would have eyes the size of satellite dishes.
So with radio astronomy, you're really not talking about mirrors, right?
I am.
Does radio astronomy involve mirrors?
Yes.
Okay.
But it depends on what you mean by a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You can look at a radio telescope, and it's shaped like a parabola.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be, because it's reflecting a kind of light. But they're long light waves. They're light waves that we can't see. But they're nonetheless a form of light, and these are mirrors. And they are concentrating these light rays. But the longer the wavelength, the less perfect your mirror surface, the less perfectly polished it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can actually be made out of chicken wire, and it will still reflect the waves, as long as the chicken wire spaces are considerably smaller than the wavelength you're trying to look at.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they are mirrors. There's no question about it.
But they're not the silvered mirrors we're used to. They're an electromagnetic mirror, in essence.
Well, they're not silvered, but they just don't have to be as perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But now, the shorter the wavelength that you're looking at, the better they have to be. So that, for instance, they have millimeter length telescopes, and they are fairly well polished. They're white surfaces, but they're solid surfaces. And they will reflect quite well enough so that if you are stupid enough to point them towards the sun,
mm-hmm.
they'll fry everything in the way of them, including I've had one story of somebody who was building one of these telescopes, and one of his fellow workers yelled at him, "Your butt's on fire," because the sun was coming in on it. Now, the other end of things, if you get to shorter wavelengths than regular light, then your mirrors have to not only be polished the way that we're familiar with them, but they have to be extraordinarily perfect, just, you know, with no room for error. And when you're trying to concentrate X-rays, which you have to do with a satellite,
mm-hmm.
because the X-rays don't come through the Earth's atmosphere. So the Chandra Space Telescope, for instance, has special mirrors in it that look like tin cans set inside one another,
mm-hmm.
kind of concentric circles. And X-rays, if you had them go in perpendicular to a regular mirror, they won't reflect. They'll just plow straight into the mirror. They'll bury themselves or even go through it. So in order to reflect them, you have to have them sort of ricochet at a 1 degree angle or less. So they call these grazing incidence mirrors. And so they come in and they go off the side of the mirror,
mm-hmm.
and they can focus them. And I interviewed a guy named Riccardo Giacconi, who just won the Nobel Prize for his work in X-ray astronomy. He was the first person to really think that there was something out there to look at. Nobody really knew whether the universe was producing X-rays. But it turns out that the most cataclysmic events, the supernovae explosions, the black holes sucking up matter, produce X-rays. And so these X-ray telescopes and these X-ray mirrors are showing us some of the most fascinating instances of the birth and death of stars.
Well, you mentioned interviewing the Nobel Prize-winning physicist. Along the way, you uncovered a lot of of interesting people. And I want to ask a question about one, but let me reintroduce you. I'm talking with Mark Pendergrass, and we're talking about his book, Mirror, Mirror, A History of the Human Love Affair with Reflection. And you can reach Mark via email at markp@nasw.org. That's markp@nasw.org. And you can visit his website at www.nasw.org/users/markp. You mentioned people like Newton, Darwin, Einstein, Nobel Prize winners, but you also uncovered information about a man named Bernhard Schmidt.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about him and what he did for astronomy?
Mm-hmm. Bernhard Schmidt was an Estonian. He grew up on a little tiny island, and he became obsessed with light the same way that I was telling you about very early on. He made a telescope out of the bottom of a bottle he found while he was beachcombing. So he was largely self-taught. And he was one of these kids who made lots of experiments when he was a kid, and one of them was he made gunpowder, and he blew off his right arm, or most of it. He blew off his right hand, actually. So he had a stump. And when he grew up, he became a professional mirror maker. He became a professional optician, primarily making mirrors for telescopes. And he was also apparently an alcoholic, but he would work for long, long hours obsessively on a mirror, because if you're grinding a mirror and you stop work on it and you come back, it won't necessarily behave the same way. So he wanted to do it all at once.
Mark, we have a couple of callers.
Okay.
And would love to fit those in. So let's start with a call from Urbana.
Is that me?
Hello?
Is that me?
Yes, that's you.
Okay. I had a couple of questions for your asking your comments on a couple of things. One is the use of mirrors in clothing in India and what the philosophy behind that is and why they do that. And secondly, I'd like you to comment on just take the word mirror in a bunch of different languages and translate that literally and see what you can make out of that.
Mark, so let's start with clothing in India. Have you heard of this at all?
Yeah. You know, the Indians like to have little tiny bits of mirrors. I know more about how they make those mirrors than about their symbolism. I would guess that it may, I mean, they just like reflective items. A lot of cultures love glitter, and it's sort of magical. But in part, it's interesting that Hinduism thinks that we're all little parts of creation, and so I think that maybe I know that they also use little mirrors in their shrines, not whole ones, but little pieces. It may be reflecting pieces of the world, but the way that they make these mirrors is very old-fashioned. It's the way they used to make them in the Middle Ages. It's the only place in the world they still make them like this, by blowing a huge globe of glass and pouring lead into it and then swishing it around and spreading it and letting it cool off and then breaking them. And so they make lots and lots of little mirrors like that.
And did you find any insights into translating the word mirror into other languages or how it's used in other languages?
Well, most of the ones I looked into came from Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And, for instance, mirror comes from mirare, I believe. I don't actually have my book in front of me, and I'm working from memory here, so I hope this is all correct.
Sure.
But it means to wonder at, to look at something in a wondering way, and so that kind of wonder comes in there. And speculum is Latin, and so espejo, or which is the Spanish for mirror. A lot of languages are based on that root, and it's interesting that the word speculation also comes from the same root.
Mark, we have a couple more callers here in the last few minutes. There's another caller from Urbana on line two, I think.
Yeah, two questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
One is, if you've got a piece of glass, what would be the easiest way to make a mirror? And the other one would be, I understand that mirrors are integral to lasers, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah.
I'll hang up. Thanks.
So, Mark, how can we make a mirror with just a piece of glass?
Well, what kind of mirror is he? Just a flat mirror?
I assume so.
Yeah. Okay. Well, get a piece of glass, clean it really well. You should really, I hate to tell people because it's kind of dangerous. It can blow up. But you get a silver nitrate solution and a reducing agent, which is usually glucose. And there's some other little things that you do, but you have to be very careful, or it'll make something called fulminating silver, which blows up on you. So get a book is what I would tell you.
You would recommend buying a mirror.
Buy a mirror, or no, you can make them. But it's just that you should read about it. Don't just take my word from a radio interview.
And our caller also alluded to lasers. Is a mirror an integral part of a laser?
Yes. How a laser works is that you have a tube with, let's say, glass in it, or it can be a solid, and you excite the molecules in that, and the molecules then excite one another all on the same wavelength, so you're producing a particular wavelength of polarized light. And on either ends of this tube, you have mirrors. One side is a mirror that is reflecting everything, and the other side, it's a partial mirror that will let's say, 5% of the light out. And you can do this either with silver, or now they make them with something called dielectric layers, which is too complicated to explain, but you can actually pinpoint which wavelength of light you want to reflect. But the basic idea of a laser is you excite all of the gas inside the tube. It keeps bouncing around back and forth between these two mirrors, but then a bit of it escapes, and that's the laser beam.
We have one more caller. It's a caller on a car phone.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. How are you? What's your question?
Well, I was just kind of wondering, and during the research, did we come to the origins of if I break a mirror, I'll have 7 years of bad luck?
All right, a little cultural history. Did you come across that, Mark?
I did come across it, and no one's quite sure where it came from. I think it's from the Romans, who believed that people's lives went in 7-year cycles. It's normal to think that breaking a mirror would cause bad luck, because, as I say, many cultures thought that a mirror captured your soul. So it was, you know, a sort of a dangerous thing. And if you broke the mirror, it was like breaking your soul. So many, many cultures consider it bad luck. I think the 7 years came from the Romans.
Mark, we have just a minute or so left. So I had a big question here at the end. Throughout the book, you really emphasize that mirrors often symbolize or show the limits of human knowledge. And what is the main question, the big question that they're trying to answer with a mirror and a telescope? What are the astronomers really after there?
Well, right now, they're trying to answer two questions. And they're trying to do it with bigger and bigger mirrors, both on Earth and in space. One is there life elsewhere in the universe? Are there other planets that have the conditions that would reveal life? And most of that is looking at the infrared. The other question is, how did the universe really begin? We want to look further and further and further back to the Big Bang. And it turns out that that also is probably in the infrared, because the short wavelengths that were produced have been stretched out as they've traveled through time and space. But they're trying to answer millions of questions. I mean, we really don't know very much about the universe that we live in.
And Mark, with that, we've run out of time, so thanks for taking the time to chat.
Thank you.